Good evening, everyone. It's good to be out on this rather blustery evening. And we have another blustery chapter, a portion of the chapter tonight to consider. And it's a difficult chapter from many perspectives. And I think all of us who studied it would agree that it's difficult. And I certainly know that if you look at commentaries, you're going to get a lot of different positions. I was surprised. I looked at Kaufman and I thought, wow, he's radically off. And that doesn't happen very often, but that's because this chapter it's difficult from our sort of Western perspective. I think we approach things with a little bit of a particular attitude, and it's difficult to understand this chapter easily. So maybe we'll have difference of opinion tonight on various subject matters. I think Malin was the last question last week, and so that means that Logan will get question number one if he wants it. What does the imagery of the downfall of the powers of the heavens indicate in biblical language? Verse 29, where it says, the powers of heaven will be shaken.
This verse is used to indicate the importance of what's going to be happening here. Similar language is used throughout the Bible when a divine judgment is being enacted on certain people. I mean, certainly the Jews had grown cold towards God, and what's about to happen here warrants this kind of language use. I'm not going to go too much into it. You've got a ton of notes on that, so I'll just leave it there.
Very good. Yes, the language speaks to the gravity of the situation. I think that's a good way to summarize it. Yes, Bill.
I kind of found myself thinking a little bit, it was almost as if symbolically, not symbolically, that it was an indication of God turning his back on Jerusalem, on Israel.
Yes, exactly. I agree completely. Yes.
I agree with that. This language, I noticed three passages in particular that similar language is used, that of Isaiah chapter 13, verse 10, where it's talking against Babylon, the fact that it was going to fall. Those are actually really good pictures.
We'll go back. Okay, there's Isaiah 13.
Isaiah 13:10. For the stars of heaven, their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened and it's going forth, and the moon will not cause its lights to shine. Perhaps you had the other ones, the one against Edom, Isaiah 34, verses 4 and 5. Against Pharaoh and Egypt, and Ezekiel chapter 32, verses 7 and 8. So if you put these things together, and obviously we know right now we're in the context of the destruction of Jerusalem, I think it's very much talking about the fact that the nation, the physical nation of Jerusalem, not of Jerusalem, but of Israel, is going to fall. That would be my take on it. Criswell, in his commentary, says, if the Holy Spirit, speaking through the prophet Isaiah, uses such figurative language to describe the downfall of a heathen nation like Babylon, how much more would not such language fit the downfall of the chosen nation of Israel?
So. Good, yes. Yeah, so, you know, we have imagery like the moon not giving its light, as we just saw. That's in Isaiah 13. The sun being darkened, again, is found there. The stars falling from heaven, and the powers of the heavens being shaken. And so it's all, the Hebrew prophets were very familiar with this language over and over again. Even smaller nations that fell received this sort of language. And so it's, what it is an exaggerated hyperbolic metaphor. It's a very descriptive language. It's stressing the gravity of the events. And here's some of the places. We've noticed Isaiah 13, but there are other places, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Amos, Micah, Nahum, Zephaniah. Peter uses Joel chapter 2 in his in the first gospel sermon that was ever given on the day of Pentecost. And so it is a theme that is found in the Old Testament, and I think we have to interpret it that way, and realizing that it is a hyperbolic idiom. The powers of darkness. It's a hyperbolic idiom that describes social, political upheaval. That's one of the commentators I found. That's how they describe it. everything's going to change. When a nation gets uprooted and discombobulated, you might say, that's social political upheaval. If America were to be taken over by China next week, and 60% of everybody was murdered, and then we had Chinese overlords, that's this sort of picture. That's what's happening in these individuals' lives. But it's also important from the standpoint of these are God's children. As we pointed out, they're the firstborn. And because they've rejected the Messiah, they're going to be overthrown. That's why all of the previous language in the Old Testament really leads to this. This is the culmination of all of that language. It's now the application is being found in the destruction of Jerusalem. Any other comments before we move on? All right. Question number two. This is another difficult question. We'll go to Landon if he wants it. What is the sign of the Son of Man? The sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And so on.
The sign is a signal, as you mentioned when we were studying. Scholars speak of it as the signature token. And it's the sign that Jesus is the rightful Messiah. That's basically what I do.
All right. Any other comments on this difficult question? I think this is one of the places where Kaufman, if I remember correctly, he thinks this is talking about the actual second coming. I don't want to misquote him, but I believe that's what he said. Yes, awesome.
Yeah, Kaufman, he goes really well for so many things. He's one of the first I go to, but he kind of dropped the ball in this chapter. Surprisingly, though, I thought Barnes actually did a pretty good job covering it. One sentence he had, he said, this is the evidence that he is coming to destroy the city of Jerusalem. That's not bad. Griswold said, many assume the sign of which Jesus speaks is his own second coming or some other phenomena that was to appear in the heavens. The sign, however, is not Jesus himself, but one that originates with Jesus, that there will be a sign on earth that undeniably shows that he has taken his rightful place in heaven at the right hand of God. So, just as Landon said a moment ago, it's a sign that he is indeed the Son of Man, and at least that's what I think, that he is sitting on the throne as such, and that the nation itself is no longer God's chosen people, but it's those who follow after him.
Very good. Yeah, the disciples had asked for a sign, right? At the beginning of the chapter, Jesus said, the temple is going to be destroyed, not one stone will be left standing upon another, and the disciples came and said, what is the sign of your coming and the end of the age? And I think the best way to interpret this is, when will you be revealed as the Messiah, and when will the Mosaic covenant end, and what is the sign of this and this coming? They're asking about the destruction of the temple. Another way to phrase this is, when would spiritual Israel, the church, be vindicated? There's 40 years between Pentecost and the destruction of Jerusalem, and the church is under siege that entire time. Paul's being chased around, disciples are being chased around, many are murdered. When are we going to have vindication for the church? What is the sign of these things? And obviously, we all know this. This is just a few of the signs in the Bible. Look up the word sign sometime in your search engine. And God talks about signs constantly. The rainbow. Moses was given two signs, leprosy and the snake. The blood on the doorpost was a sign for God to pass over. There were no flies in Goshen when the flies came, one of the plagues. God says that's a sign. When Korah and the apostates were swallowed up, that's a sign. The altar that was split open in 1 Kings 13 was a sign. Hophni and Phinehas died on the same day in prophecy, and that was a sign, God said. The shadow on the sundial that went back as a sign. And Isaiah 7:14, the virgin will conceive as a sign. So this is common language, and this is, when we're talking about the sign of the Son of Man being the Messiah, this is a badge of identity. As Landon pointed out, the scholars describe this as a signature token. And, that's funky PhD language. It's a badge of ID. When you go into many workplaces now, you have to have a badge. and I'm the kind of guy that lets my badge expire, and then I have to, in humiliation, walk to security and have them punch it in the computer again and get me cleared. Jesus is showing his proof of identity via this sign. For the 40 years between destruction of Jerusalem and the Pentecost, people are like, your Jesus is nobody. He was murdered. We don't believe he was resurrected. We're able to chase you around the Jewish world and kill you and persecute you. And so we don't believe your Jesus is the Messiah. Here is his signature token. Your city, God's Mosaic covenant, the temple, are going to be destroyed. So that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about Jesus coming back in the sky. Yes, go ahead.
Very well said, Bart, and the other guys. You mentioned, no stone upon another. All of their historical records, all of those treasures that they hung their hat on, gone. their world's been turned upside down. And between this study, the destruction, I read your dad's book, right, hit that article, and I didn't appreciate what the destruction of Jerusalem did to propagation,
mm-hmm.
to get New Testament Christians scattered.
Yeah, scattered throughout the Judea and
Samaria. And the persecution, as you just said, was going on.
Right.
Impressive.
Very good. All right, and that leads, those comments, Bill, lead into question number 3, which will be for Levi if he wants it. What coming of Christ is described here and why? Let's just read these verses. A sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. That sounds like the end of time. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. That sounds like the end of time too. And verse 31 really sounds like the end of time. He will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together as elect from the four winds from one end of the heaven to the other. Levi, yeah. Let's tackle this.
It's gonna be a little bit bumpy, but okay. So I wasn't really sure what the question was asking, so I'm just gonna try and break down what I think all of these phrases mean. We talked about it in our study earlier. So, sign of man will appear in heaven. That is the destruction of Jerusalem. All the tribes of the earth will mourn. That's all the 12 tribes of Israel. As for the see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with great glory, I think that's just trying to declare how he's the Messiah, and it's awesome. Lost my place here. He'll send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. We talked about it. Angel can mean messenger. So what I think this is that the gospel is being propagated by messengers, because it says they'll gather his elect from the four winds. So I think that's all the Gentiles. And then from one and the other, we didn't know what that is. But you might ask, if that's what that means, why didn't he just say that? But I feel like he's using all this language because it really is an epic event. I feel like all the Gentiles being gathered together and everything, I feel like that is a culmination of so much stuff in the Old Testament, and I just feel like that's why Jesus is using all this language, because it's not just something super simple. But,
Yeah, remember, he's already given the very specific prophecies. There's going to be earthquakes and famines and pestilences. And then the armies of the Romans will surround Jerusalem. And then, he says, the sign of the Son of Man will appear. And so he's given very specific, and I agree that this is flowery, hyperbolic language. We might wonder why Jesus didn't say in more modern language, this just means that I am the Messiah, but he chose to use Old Testament language, obviously. Hebrew idiom. Any other comments? I'll show my slides and then see if anybody. So Doug Edwards has a sermon on the comings of Christ, which you might want to listen to. Which coming is this that Jesus is referring to here in this question? Well, this is debatable, but back in Matthew 10, 21 to 23, Jesus told his disciples while he was still alive that you're going to go out and bad times are going to come. Brothers will deliver each other up to death. A father will put his child to death. Because of Christianity, a father is child. Children will rise up against parents, put them to death. You will be hated by all, but he who endures to the end will be saved, which obviously is suggestive of this chapter. When they persecute you in one city, flee to another. I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel
before the Son of Man comes. Now, what's he talking about there? Is he talking about the establishment of the kingdom on Pentecost? It's difficult to squeeze all of this persecution into that 50 days. We're not aware of the record of these things happening during that 50 days, but we are aware of this happening during the 40 years between Pentecost and the destruction of Jerusalem. Christianity was persecuted. Nero covered Christians in tar and pitch and burned them for lights in the city of Rome. Christians were thrown in the arena and their children were torn apart, and so on and so forth. It was a terrible time of persecution for Christians. Jesus is telling them that this is going to be happening. You will be hated by all. The Jews will persecute you, and they'll be able to get the Romans to assist them. And you won't have gone through all the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. So there's a time limit on this, 40 years. And then the Son of Man will come. I think this is the coming, and it, you know, again, you can debate this, but I think this is the coming that he's speaking about here. What about this language? All the tribes of the earth will mourn. Is that everybody on earth? If you look at this as the second coming, you say, well, everybody's going to mourn when they see Jesus. The word earth can be translated land, region, or country. This is Mike Criswell. So all the 12 tribes of the country or of the nation, of the region, will mourn. The tribes of physical Israel will mourn because Jesus is shown as the Messiah. They've rejected the Messiah, and now their cities to be destroyed. They will mourn. So this isn't talking about all the people of the earth. This is the 12 tribes. They will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with power and glory. Is this the second coming when Jesus comes back in the clouds and we will see him? No, because this language is used in other places to describe the Lord revealing his presence in the Old Testament. When Egypt was judged, it is described there as the Lord riding on a swift cloud. Did God actually come on a cloud when Egypt was judged? No, he didn't. It's a metaphor. It's hyperbolic language. Egypt was judged in a physical sense, and this is a metaphor saying God showed up and judged Egypt. He didn't actually show up in a cloud, and Jesus didn't actually show up in the clouds of heaven. It is hyperbolic language. What about, does Jesus ever underscore this interpretation? Matthew 16, he said, there's some standing here who will not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now, maybe this is Pentecost, or maybe this is the destruction of Jerusalem. We can debate that. But either way, did Jesus actually come back in his kingdom on the day of Pentecost or in AD 70 physically? No, he didn't. And so, again, this kind of language is used elsewhere. He will send out his angels with the sound of a trumpet. Levi kind of pointed to this. Is this the second coming? It sure sounds like the second coming, except for the fact that angels means messengers. That's what the word apostle means, someone who is sent, a messenger. And angels can mean people like us or apostles. Matthew 11, Luke 7, Mark 1, James 2. And so Criswell says, Jesus is depicting a time after AD 70 when his disciples, his messengers, will go into all the world, preach the gospel, and gather the elect into the church. From the four corners of the earth, the Gentiles will be brought into the kingdom. And they weren't opposed in the same way they were pre-AD 70. The Jews had money and influence with the Romans. Pre-AD 70, they didn't have post-AD 70. The Romans just wanted to kill Jews after AD 70. If you were a Jew in a Roman territory after AD 70, you were in trouble because they had rebelled. They had fought against the Roman legions. They had said the Caesar wasn't king. And so Jews were not well tolerated post AD 70. And so they didn't have the influence they had anymore to persecute Christians. So that's what this is talking about. After AD 70, the gospel is sent out without as much persecution from the Jews. Obviously, there was still some persecution in the Roman world, but the Jews didn't have the ability to chase people around like they had previously done. Okay, other comments about yes, awesome.
Honestly, I kind of want to take a crack at Levi's other question there, which I thought was a really good question. Why does he use hyperbolic language to talk about these things? Completely agree with everything you said prior and what he said prior. This is my thought. Again, it's open for discussion, but it's one thing to tell what is going to happen. It's another thing to tell someone why it's going to happen. And to me, if imagine he's describing judgment upon, say, New York City. New York City is going to be destroyed in judgment. So he's describing to them something that's going to happen in judgment. It's the right thing to do. It's the righteous thing to do because of what they've done. This is God's way of justice upon the nation of Israel. But to us and to our small minds, all we can see is this is just something bad. These are terrible things that are going to happen, and why would God allow terrible things to happen? So the best explanation that I have, again, it's a great question, but I think he's telling them why this is going to happen, why this is the right thing to happen, and to look at it that way, that it's the Son of Man coming in power and great glory. It's not going to look like that, but that is what is happening, and they need to understand that.
Yeah, it's very good. I think that's well worded. The Lord obviously says everything perfectly, and this is said exactly the way it needed to be said. Prophecy is in the Old Testament and the New is never crystal clear, so that even an unbeliever or a skeptic can just read it and go, "Whoa!" You know, the perfect it's a 70-week prophecy. God could have said in 490 years after this event, then the Messiah is going to be born, and then 30 years later he's going to be crucified. He could have been extremely specific, but instead, to some degree, it's cloaked and veiled so that you have to be a student of Scripture. You have to have the knowledge, the desire to seek after God. And I think that's part of the reason, too, that this is not super explicit. Instead, it takes, a little bit of, it takes an understanding of the Old Testament. To understand these things. That's why the denominations, to a large degree, don't get it. Other comments? All right, let's move on then to, right there. Question 4. How does the parable of the fig tree help us?
We'll see in your next slide. Kind of makes me wish I went that direction this question. I thought about it, but I'm interested to see what you have to say about it. But honestly, it's a sign, and he's already told me before, but when you see the signs, know that the time is near. The same thing here with the fig tree. When the fig tree is putting forth its leaves, everybody knows when you start seeing buds on trees, summer's coming. And to me, that's at the heart of what he's telling them. When you see the signs, know that it's coming even afterwards, as he says.
Yeah, very good. Other comments on the fig tree? Well, I took this from the perspective of the fig tree is a well-known image of the nation of Israel being barren and fruitless. Back in Matthew 21, which was just obviously a few chapters ago, Jesus had cursed a fig tree, and there was nothing on it but leaves. So he came to the tree, it looked like it had borne fruit, because this tree bears the fruit and then the leaves come. It's the way the fig tree works, according to the sources I read. I've never actually had a fig tree. But the sources say it bears the fruit first, strangely enough, and then the leaves show up. So you see the tree from a distance as you're walking to the tree, and you think, there's going to be figs on it, and you get to the tree, and there's no figs. And so that happens near the end of the Lord's ministry. He only found leaves, and then he cursed the fig tree. And in the Old Testament, and I meant to look up the Old Testament prophet, but Israel is compared to a fig tree in the Old Testament. We covered this actually back in chapter 21 by one of the prophets. And so it is an image then. The fig tree is an image of the Jewish people. And so even though they looked like they were bearing fruit, they had leaves, they had every conceivable spiritual advantage, but they were renegades. And in the scriptures, a withered, fruitless tree is worthy of being cut down. Psalm 90, Hosea 9. And Joel 1 says, withering is a sign of imminent death. And so what the Lord, why this fig tree is here, is because it's a symbol of of the fruitless nation of Israel, worthy of nothing but destruction. And it's, the summer has come, and there's leaves on the tree. It's put forth leaves, but there's no fruit, and the tree is going to be dead from its very roots. I think that, to me, that is why this image of the fig tree is included here. So Jesus is warning them, here comes the judgment. You've got a fruitless tree. And when you see these signs, obviously he's backing up this picture with these signs, the signs of pestilence, earthquakes, famines, abomination of desolation, and so on. When you see these signs, you know that the judgment is near. And get out of the city. Other comments? All right. Bill, yeah.
Yeah, so Luke's account in chapter 21, Luke doesn't call this a fig tree. So I went down that path looking at trees, and you know, the idea that, you know, this fig tree is a hardwood tree as opposed to your softwood conifers and cedars and things. So they're going to have this whole pattern of putting on and dropping leaves every year. So Luke 21 describes it as a tree, and to me often hit on it's no different than leaves on a tree. The blossoms on the blackberries, the dogwoods flowering, all those are signs. You know, those are signs. You know, we can, you know, it's kind of like we can discern that.
Which verse are you using? Well, I've got Luke 21:29. It says, "Look at the fig tree."
It does. Well, maybe it was a new. You know what? It might have been a new King, or it might have been a King James
okay.
version.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, because I thought it was the same
in both places.
But I don't disagree. I think you're right with that. Other comments? All right. Let's see. Oh, wait. We're on question 5. Why is verse 34 one of the most important in the whole chapter? Huh?
Well, if it wasn't there, I think it would be a whole lot harder to interpret this chapter. It would definitely present a lot more challenges. You could make the argument that generation is maybe not referring, kind of like world, that it has a dual meaning, that it, you know, could be referring to the Jews or Christians of all time. But certainly, it bookends all of these things and says this is what's got to happen. And it gives us a whole lot more context when reading through this chapter.
I couldn't agree more. Without verse 34, we'd be lost. But verse 34 is the anchor to this chapter. All you have to do is remember verse 34. All these things will happen before this generation passes. The exegetical commentary, which is a Greek exegetical summation of this very word here in Matthew 24, says, people now living, people of this time, people of this generation. Mike Criswell says there's absolutely no reason this word should mean anything except for these people, this generation, will not pass away before all these things take place. And so it's an absolute anchor and marker that everything we're talking about had to happen in that generation. And it makes sense when you look at it from the Hebrew language viewpoint. Any other comments? Yes, awesome.
Just once again, Barnes, for some reason, I don't remember his background. I want to say that he believes in some kind of predestination theory. I feel like I've read that in some of his plays. But again, he's surprisingly honest here. And he looks at this generation, he says this age, this race of people, a generation is about 30 or 40 years. The destruction of Jerusalem took place about 40 years after this was spoken. So again, fits exactly as far as the wording here. Again, like you said, the wording that God chooses is always perfect. He says, this generation will by no means pass away. And he's giving them a time frame. In addition to all the signs that they're going to be looking for, now he's giving them time. This is what you should be looking for. This is when it's going to happen, when before this generation passes away. So
very good. And we pointed this out, Austin, you weren't here, but back when we were looking in the book of Numbers when people were wandering in the wilderness. They wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, and that whole generation passed away. Every single one of them, except for Caleb and Joshua, and maybe the high priest and so on, they all died in the wilderness, and their bodies were left in the sand. So this is a direct reference. You have one generation to make things right with God. And those Jews, your ancestors, those who actually saw and knew Moses failed to do that, and they all died in the wilderness. And anyone who didn't become a Christian and follow after the Messiah and stay in Jerusalem also died. All right, Bill, last question is for you. If I can get to where, here we go. How sure and certain are the words of Christ?
Well, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 25. But the word of the Lord endures forever. John chapter 12, verse 48. The word that I've spoken will judge him in the last day. And Jesus speaking in that verse. You can back on.
Very good. Yeah, and what we talked about when we studied this is how there are fragments of the Gospel of Mark that predate AD 70, and we don't have actual, Matthew. But Jesus' words in Mark 13, no doubt, were written down in Mark's Gospel. Some of these concepts are in Mark 13, and so it predates destruction of Jerusalem, so does Matthew and Luke, obviously, but we don't have older copies of that. And the Christians, Josephus tells us, knew these prophecies, right? The Christians knew these prophecies, and not as Josephus records, who wasn't a Christian, Josephus was a Jew, a Roman collaborator. He reports that all the Christians fled the city, which was going against the tide. Everybody else was going into the city. It was Passover. And so all the people were swelling the city. But the Christians all left because they had these words. And so that's what I thought about as an answer. Jesus, 40 years before these events, predicts the destruction of Jerusalem with extremely specific detail, enough so that the Christians, we laughed about it because there's no way I would have been hanging out in Jerusalem anywhere near the time of the army showing up. I would have sold my business, packed up all my stuff, and moved to Alexandria, Egypt. Bye-bye. We're not hanging around for the destruction. But apparently somebody did. Although, not exactly clear how many did, but a few Christians waited to the last possible minute before they got out. That's how certain and sure the words of Jesus were. And it's irrefutable, frankly. It's irrefutable historically as well. That's awesome.
Just one closing thought here. In one sense, I think we can all look at these words and the verses that Bill mentioned and take great comfort. But in another sense, it's almost chilling in the fact that these things will come to pass. Heaven and earth will pass away before my words pass away. And there will be no negotiation. Jerusalem will fall, and justice will be served. So, to me, and I think Chriswell brought that out too, there's a certain chilling certainty that all these things will, in fact, come to pass. As well as the many wonderful things, obviously, that the Lord talks about. But in this context, I take it a little bit of a more solemn one, perhaps.
Right. And what's interesting is this is a transition verse for the rest of the chapter, which really does talk about the second coming. And many of the things that are mentioned in hyperbolic language in the first part of the destruction of Jerusalem actually are going to happen in the end of the world. Jesus will return in power and glory in the clouds. Every eye will see him. There will be a trumpet blast, and the angels will go forth. So just like the destruction of Jerusalem happened with surety, despite what our culture says, we know that these things will happen. So, yes.
One more thing, real quick. And again, from my readings, the words that Criswell, a couple, two or three, four different times, quoted another writer, Kirk Kick.
Yeah, Kick.
Mm-hmm. And I think he was quoting Kick when he said that the destruction of Jerusalem, he called it a death blow to the nation of Israel. And again, I didn't appreciate that and what that did and how that freed up Christianity then to have access and be able to go about unabated and be able to make a difference in the world. I thought that was really powerful. And none of that would have happened without the destruction of Jerusalem. I think that's huge.
Think about, we're covering Galatians now, Brother Austin's covering it, and how powerful the Judaizing teachers were, and how they could go into these new Neophyte congregations and say, oh, you've got to do this. Look at the temple. Look over here at the temple, blah, blah, blah. And then, boom, Romans destroy Jerusalem, level Jerusalem to the ground. They rename it after a pagan god. They put up a temple to their pagan god in the middle of Jerusalem, and then they start killing Jews throughout the entire kingdom. Those Judaizing teachers are either dead or on the run, and so the major issue that Paul faced is over. Now, other issues are about to crop up, but that issue is put to an end, and the Jews, their root has withered, and I think we see evidence of that in the modern world in the sense that Christianity has not taken hold, unfortunately. I'm sure there's some, but wish there were many more. Any other comments? Yes, Grant.
I just have one thing to say. The certainty is such that it makes me think of the Old Testament prophecies where they were so certain that they were actually spoken of in the past tense. Mm-hmm. They've already happened.
Yes. So that's very good. Right. Certain and sure. Very good. Well, thanks. Oh, yes, Leo.
Sorry, I just wanted to bring something up really, really quick. This isn't exactly on the question of the subject, but and Luke or Matthew chapter 23, verse 37 says, O Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. I feel like some of the reasons Jesus was using the cosmic darkness language is because they're not under his fold anymore. Now they're getting surrounded by Romans eventually, and it's dark, and there's no shelter for them anymore. Because they've killed all the prophets and rejected him. Right. What Jesus has done.
And they're the first one, which we planned and pointed out so eloquently. It's a terrible, terrible thing when your child rejects your leadership and goes their own way. That's what happened. Appreciate everyone's comments.